From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new movie Clockers, about cops and teenage crack dealers, is based on a novel by Richard Price. Price shares the screenwriting credit with Spike Lee, who directed the film. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Richard Price recorded just after the publication of Clockers, in which he talked about his research hanging out with cops and crack dealers. Randy Newman has written a new musical based on the Faust story. The music just came out on CD. We'll feature his 1992 Fresh Air interview and performance. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut solo album by the Icelandic singer Björk, formerly of the band The Sugar Cubes. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new film Unstrung Heroes, directed by Diane Keaton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Air Force reports a high-tech military surveillance plane crashed on takeoff today from Alaska's Elmendorf Air Force Base. 24 people were aboard. The crew's fate is not known. The Air Force says an AWACS plane was going out for a training mission and a huge plume of smoke was seen in the area. This is the latest in a string of major Air Force aircraft crashes this year. Not counting today's crash, 29 people have died in Air Force plane crashes this year. Publisher Malcolm Forbes Jr. has joined the Republican race for president. Steve Forbes, as he's known, is pledging to cut the dead weight of Washington from business and let the American economy run free. Forbes, the heir to the Forbes publishing empire, says he's entering the race because he wants to bring the nation an optimistic vision and a return to traditional values.
Values also mean rediscovering our moral compass in this world as a leader and light among nations, a bastion of freedom, as strong as we are restrained. We need a president who has a U.S., not a U.N. foreign policy, one who understands that the wise and judicious use of American power is now and has been the best hope of the world.
Forbes also supports a 17% flat tax and a proposal to again link the U.S. dollar to a gold standard. Forbes is a late starter in the Republican presidential race. He's vowed to spend as much as $25 million of his own money on the campaign. Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt went to Capitol Hill today. He strongly protested the appropriations that Congress has approved for his agency. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
It was an angry Bruce Babbitt who surveyed an appropriations bill that cuts the Interior Department 13% from President Clinton's request, and that Babbitt says will do major damage to programs such as the Endangered Species Act, the National Park System, and Native American support, and enrich mining and other commercial interests.
The lobbyists are really in control of this place. They're all over. The money changers are swarming through the temples of democracy.
Babbitt says he's already strongly recommended that President Clinton veto the Interior Appropriations Bill. Bill Small, Washington.
Meanwhile, Vice President Al Gore says Mr. Clinton will indeed veto that spending bill. Gore says the bill takes dead aim at America's natural resources. The proposed merger agreement between Time Warner and Turner Broadcasting is already running into trouble. Time Warner's telephone partner, U.S. West, says it's filed suit to block the deal. It says Time Warner was supposed to get the utility's permission first. Meanwhile, the Consumers Union says it will ask the Justice Department to block the deal, too. This group is concerned there will be higher cable and phone rates and that viewers will be prevented from getting some programming. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up a little more than a point at 4,768. This is NPR. Power has been restored to a nuclear submarine base that was in danger of overheating. NPR's Anne Gerrels reports.
The Kola Peninsula Power Authority in the Russian far north had cut off electricity because the northern fleet owed it almost $5 million. The cutoff left four decommissioned nuclear subs without outside power. The onboard cooling system on one sub failed and its reactors began to overheat. The commander of the northern fleet took matters into his own hands, ordering all local power stations supplying the fleet's nuclear installations to be put under military guard so they couldn't turn off power at their own discretion. Under the law, however, stations are permitted to cut off electricity to any customers who don't make payments. According to the Russian Defense Ministry, the Russian armed forces cannot pay their utility bills. This is only the most recent in a series of power cuts. Last week, a local power station cut off electricity to the strategic missile base at Plesetsk. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
A former deputy attorney general says a bad choice of words could be to blame for the Ruby Ridge incident. George Terwilliger says orders telling FBI snipers they should fire at armed adults on white separatist Randy Weaver's homestead were clearly wrong. Terwilliger told senators today he doesn't think that meant that agents were supposed to shoot on sight, but he acknowledged that it was a close question. The FBI's field commander at Ruby Ridge testified earlier this week that higher-ups approved the shoot-on-site orders. This led to a shootout and the deaths of Weaver's wife, son, and a federal agent. The federal government has set out new rules on when emergency room doctors can experiment on a patient. The rules say hospital research boards would have to approve any work done. The studies would only be allowed under certain conditions. These include when a patient is unconscious and normal consent cannot be given, when known treatments will not work, and when the risk of the experiment is reasonable compared to other therapies. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Spike Lee's new movie, Clockers, is based on the novel of the same name by Richard Price. Price shares the screenwriting credit with Lee. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have a 1992 interview with Price, recorded just after the publication of his novel Clockers. Price also wrote the novels The Wanderers and The Breaks, and the screenplays for The Color of Money, Sea of Love, Mad Dog and Glory, and Kiss of Death. Clockers is about a teenage crack dealer named Strike, played in the film by Mickey Pfeiffer, and a cop named Rocco Klein, played by Harvey Keitel. The cop is called in to investigate the murder of another dealer. Strike's brother, who has kept away from the drug world and works two jobs, is arrested for the murder. The cop believes Strike really did it, and in this scene from the film, the cop tries to talk Strike into confessing.
I know your brother is an innocent man, just like you do. And the victor was my brother, and I knew what you know. Every day of my life would be a living hell. You think there's something we can do about this here, Ronnie?
Do about what?
We all know who did that, Limes.
You did it. I know it. You know it. Your brother knows it. What's your thinking on this?
That because Victor's going to claim self-defense, he'll get off because he has no record?
Oh, God.
Well, his life is over. Listen to me. I talked to all your brothers. Listen to me. Look at me. I got something nice to say. I talked to all your brother's people. You know what? You know what? He's one of the decent ones. And probably in his deluded decency, he thinks he's doing a noble thing with you here. But you and Victor playing me for a patsy?
The novel Clockers is told in the alternating points of view of the teenage drug dealer and the cop. When I spoke with Price about Clockers, he described the story and read an excerpt.
One of the main characters in the book is this kid Strike, who's a 19-year-old drug dealer, who's a sub-lieutenant for this other guy who's an older, more charismatic figure in the community. He's a drug dealer that has Strike and a dozen kids working for him. And his name is Rodney. And what Rodney likes to do is he likes to take five of his young drug dealers for sort of a booster club, Chamber of Commerce-type lunch, where he lectures them on having the right attitude. And the kids never really get what Rodney's saying because they're too young and too immature in their life is, you know, too scattered and impulsive. And Strike is the only guy that Rodney's ever gotten through to, and Strike has become sort of his de facto son and his young prince. And at this point, Rodney has been lecturing the kids for about 15 minutes about bank books and prudence and everything, and the kids are all spacing out on him. And this is Strike's thoughts about what Rodney has just put forth to all the other drug dealers. Strike guessed that he was probably the only kid who had ever received Rodney's restaurant lecture and understood right away what he was saying. During that first lunch a year ago, Rodney's eyes had lit up with gratitude and pride when he saw Strike stay right with him. Finally, he'd saved one. Rodney's other clockers always went down. They were too poor, too immature, a lifetime of one way going up against 2 months of the other way. Other way didn't stand a chance. You got to start respecting yourself. Rodney was still hammering away, not ready to give up. The kid that spends it as fast as he makes it don't believe it's real, don't believe in himself. He's thinking like with a two-minute clock, thinking like a poor man, like his life is day-to-day, minute-to-minute. He got no future because he don't think of no future. Strike watched the kids tune out, dip in fries and ketchup, one by one turning to wave down the waitress and order orange sodas or Cokes, their cognacs left unfinished. You got to believe in yourself. You got to start thinking about your future. And that means you got to start saving your damn money. Hell, they do, Rodney pointed out to the room.
There ain't a person in this restaurant right now can't go home and show me a bank book. And you kids making more day by day, week by week than them all. But I'll bet come the end of the month they got more than you do. Rodney whirled his hands around each other, cocking his head. Do you all get what I'm saying?
I hear that, Charles said automatically. Rodney sagged with frustration, looking like the old man of 37 he was, then said, well, the hell with it. I tried, and got back to his ribs.
Strike was relieved that the lecture seemed to be over, glad that Rodney didn't do his self-image exercise, making everybody come up with a positive word that started with the same letter as their first name. Going around the table, people saying stuff like terrific Tyrone, sexy Strike, rockin' Rodney. 6 months ago, one kid had called himself Brightful Booker, and then almost put his fork in someone's chest when everybody laughed. But Rodney wasn't done. He lit up again, tried one last approach. I mean, look at Strike here.
The kids did as they were told, Strike looking away as if he had seen something out at the bar.
Look how my man dressed. No flash, color-coordinated, nice pair of dark Reeboks, none of them paratrooper sneakers you all like to wear. Jump out a window, you bounce right back.
No one laughed. I mean, check this out. The narcotics roll up on my man at a red light. What do they see? Because you know they're going to be profiling. They see a kid in a 2-year-old Accord, no gold on, nice hair, not no high-rise billboard up top his head, nice dark sweater, probably driving like my grandma. You think the narcotics going to be thinking clocker?
Hell no, they thinking a 9-to-5 kid working at First Jersey or some damn thing. Strike's doing it right. Strike's getting over, cause Strike's quiet storm.
Strike fumed, thinking lose the Accord. A table of strangers now knowing it's a dope car. And Strike's got himself a safe. Abruptly, Strike rose from his chair. Now they all knew he saved it, which meant he's got it. Rodney getting him killed. Strike stood over Rodney, trying to hold in his anger, keep himself stone-faced and without stammering.
I got to book. I got to see my parole officer.
As Strike walked from the table, he heard Rodney say, Strike's got like 4 safes. So come knock night, when the knockos come down, they can't confiscate his money. See what I'm saying? I mean, Strike's here to stay.
Strike palmed his gut. Lose the safes. Lose the Accord. Lose Rodney, too.
Richard Price, how did you start observing this scene?
Well, in 1986, I was going out with cops in Hudson County, New Jersey, sort of soaking up some atmosphere for Sea of Love. And I got very hooked on seeing the world through cops' eyes, because when you run with cops, you see, you know, humans in such extremis. You get, you never see life on such a life and death level, day in, day out, night times, day times. It wasn't that I was crazy about cops, but I just wanted to keep witnessing, you know, all this human struggle. And at some point, I decided that I would like to leave the cops' point of view and see the world through the eyes of those that the cops deal with, which are the world of the victims, the world of the predators, and all the people for which the cop in the neighborhood coming down very quickly is more prevalent than the mailman coming.
But how did you get connected to the dealers? It's easier to call up a precinct and ask for permission to drive
the cops
around with
called
cops.
The cops called the dealers for me. It's, you know, in a mid-sized city, the way law and order works, it's real flexible. I mean, everybody needs everybody. A homicide investigator won't solve any crimes if he doesn't have people talking to him. And if you don't do favors for people, people won't do favors for you. And everything is relative. So, yeah, you skipped your hearing and there's a warrant out on you and a cop says, well, I'll fix it for you, but remember my name. And, you know, the guy's going to have to remember his name. Or, you know, the criminal's got a problem and he'll come to the cop and say, listen, if you can get me out from under the rock, I'll give you a name on something else which is heavier. Or I'll turn over the guys that I've been dealing with buying from in greater quantity. It's all little fish giving up bigger fish.
So when you first approached dealers and told them that you were writing a book and you wanted to follow them for a while, what kind of rap did you give them?
Well, I just met them through the cops. I met them in the homicide office. There's one guy and you know, we just talk for you. People just check you out, and basically they want to see, A, if hanging out with you is going to put them in jeopardy. B, are you a jerk? I certainly wasn't going to put anybody in jeopardy for helping me out. And I guess I wasn't big enough jerk for them to say no. And, after a 3-hour conversation, the dealer in front of the cop said, well, you ought to walk a mile in my shoes. Why don't you come on out with me tomorrow night? I looked at the cop and he said, sure, why not?
What were the rules you had to follow when you were traveling or hanging out with dealers?
There were no rules. It wasn't like, now I'm going to take you to a place, don't look anybody in the eye. It was none of that stuff. I was with, the baddest guy in town. So it was like, where does a 500-pound gorilla sit anywhere he wants? I'm with him. I'm with Gorgo over here. So, don't lose sight of him. Don't let him wander off and, leave you alone. I mean, I wouldn't be in that place for a nanosecond without a guy like that.
How would he explain you to other people?
Just say, I'm this writer. I got this writer coming around and, they'd look at him and, everybody got used to seeing me because I was, at some times I would be like the only white guy around. And, if they see a white guy walking around in circles like that who's not obviously a customer, the second thought is that the guy's a cop. So this guy Rodney, the Rodney character, basically had to constantly calm people down and explain to them that, I'm not there, that my presence is not a danger to them, and I should be allowed to live.
My guest is Richard Price, author of the novel Clockers and co-author of the screenplay. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Screenwriter and novelist Richard Price is my guest. Now, you hung out with cops a lot as part of your research, too.
Right.
And I'm wondering if the cops, knowing that you were also hanging out with dealers, ever tried to get information from you.
Oh, well, the funny thing is that I hung out with everybody so much, people kind of forgot that I was a writer, and they started telling me more than they were telling the guy that sent me to him in the first place. I mean, they were, occupationally adversaries. So he would say, to the cop who sent me over, hey, man, don't tell him this, but, he thinks I'm over here, but I'm really over there, And then I'd run with the cop, and he'd say, well, don't tell Rodney this, but, he thinks I'm over here, but I'm really over there. So in a way, I knew more than, I was like the girlfriend between this married couple, and it was kind of like a marriage between these cops and these dope dealers, because, as I said, they needed each other. Every once in a while, somebody would pull a real number on me. Like I was, my standard fee was like $100 for a sit down. If you sit down, answer my questions for $3, I'll buy you some drinks and I'll buy you a steak, and you get $100 change. And I sat down with this narcotics cop, and he talked for about 2 hours, and I gave him $100, and he took the money, but he didn't say thank you, and he gave me kind of like a dirty look, which I couldn't figure out. I was a little paranoid. And the next night, I went out with one of the drug dealers. And I spent, a number of hours with him, at the end of which he got his pay, and he started laughing. And I said, what's so funny? He says, yeah. He says, you gave Frank $100 last night, didn't you? He says, yeah, last time I had a meet with Frank, I told him you were paying me $500. things like that would happen. But that's what I mean. There was like an intimacy there that at its base is potentially deadly and deceptively relaxed. But it's not, you there, drop that gun. I mean, it's real flexible out there. There's not too many oak trees. There's lots of willows.
Did you get the impression that the cops respected the dealers and the dealers respected the cops on some level?
No, respect is a funny word. Understood is a better word. I mean, mm-hmm. People understood why people did the way that it's really, unless you're brain dead, if you're a cop and you're out there a certain number of years, you have to have some getting of wisdom about why people are the way they are and how people act in certain situations. I don't think there's a cop in the world who doesn't deep down inside understand how a kid can, at 15 or 16, turn into a drug dealer, given what he's seen since that kid had been born in that neighborhood. And there's probably the more reflective cops always wind up saying, there but for the grace of God go I. If I had been born in this project, I don't know, I probably wouldn't be a cop. I'd probably be like him.
One of your cops in the novel says he's done so many strip searches over the years that there's one guy's underwear who he is more familiar with than his own. What's the etiquette for you when you're standing by watching a strip search?
I don't help. I mean, I just, you know, I just stand there back discreetly, and the kids were going crazy because they couldn't figure out who I was. This sixth white guy in this car that used to come down and make their lives miserable at any time of night or day. And they knew those five guys. They christened them. They gave them their street names. And so when there's a sixth guy that they don't know, they get all hinky because they say, who the hell is this guy? Is this a new guy we have to worry about? Well, he doesn't look like a cop. You know, he's kind of skinny. He looks a little scared. He doesn't have a gun. Do you think maybe he's a special cop? Or maybe he's a commissioner? Or maybe, you know, he's a lawyer? But they were going crazy trying to figure out who I was. And I don't want to make eye contact with anybody because then they're going to see, you know how much I'm really holding it in. And until I finally heard one guy say really out loud, that guy ain't no cop, man. Look how scared he is. Of course, which you completely fall apart when they say that. But
cops and dealers tend to have their own language. And I wonder if that's one of the things that interests you as a writer.
Oh sure, you know I've always been into the way the urban patois, you know, of any group. What I decided to do is that some of these kids were, it sounded like Lord Buckley to me, or somebody. You have to listen 10 times before you understand what they're saying. But by and large, I decided to forego, you know, doing the Margaret Mead number and getting the glossary right, because I figured even if I nailed it, you know, by the time it hits the book, it's old news. You know, so I just decided to concentrate on good dialogue, which is to say dialogue which, because of the progression of the words, captures the way that individual metabolizes his thoughts.
Is clockers a word you made up yourself?
No, clockers is a word I heard from a kid in the Bronx, and I heard from another kid in Jersey City, but I didn't hear it that often. It basically means the kids get addicted to selling as much as other people get addicted to smoking it. The transaction of bottles for cash is an addicting ritual. And I had kids tell me about how they developed constipation problems because they got so hung up on the money they were making down there. They were holding it in. They didn't want to go upstairs and sit on the toilet and miss all that money. It was an addiction, and they were clocking, which is to say they were there around the clock.
I know you spent some time teaching at Daytop, which is a drug rehabilitation center.
Right.
You were teaching writing, reading.
Well, I was volunteer teaching creative writing. I was, I had my own drug problem in the early 80s, and sort of when I cleaned myself up, I decided that I should take it a step further, and I went to Daytop to, just talk to the kids that were trying to deal with drugs that was so much more potent and pernicious than the stuff that I fell down on at a such more vulnerable age and with such more hideous backgrounds than I had. I just sort of felt like, let me go in here and tell them, listen, I have it a lot easier than you in this world, you know, and I couldn't handle, you know, three-cut party coke, and you guys are doing kryptonite, you know. I couldn't handle it, you know, and I'm here to tell you that. And then, you know, from there, I just say, you know, it's sort of like going into an AA meeting and saying, hi, you know, my name is Bob, I'm an alcoholic, you know. I mean, it's like I was in no better shape than any of them. And then, you know, from there, we'd go on and do writing exercises, try to get them to do some experiential writing and express themselves.
Did you like that? Did you like teaching there?
Yeah, I did, because it's not the usual. The thing is, I actually probably enjoy teaching adults and, you know, people in circumstances, educational circumstances like that, much better than I do teaching in a regular American University, because it's so much more of a struggle for that kid or for that adult to be present in that classroom. It's much more of a conscious choice. It's not that, well, I'm 19 now and I'm supposed to be here, so I'm here. I mean, there's a hunger present in the classroom that I find, much more electrifying.
I think you're probably in the process now of turning your novel Clockers into a screenplay, or has that been done already?
Well, I'm taking a shot at it.
So you're still working on it?
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. You know, it's the never ending story.
So where do you start? You wrote the novel first. Now you're turning it into a screenplay.
What you do, the first thing you do with a book when you make it into a script is throw it out the window. It's what I did on Color of Money. Unfortunately, the book is mine, and I know every line by heart.
Mm-hmm.
And you're supposed to obviously kill your darlings, but I thought I killed all my darlings, and I still have a 300-page script. It's like Lonesome Dove. So I have a lot of work to do and a lot of rethinking. It's very hard. I mean, what a screenwriter does is reinvent
a novel for a different art form. He really doesn't know anything to the novel except to capture the spirit of what the book was about. And what you have to do is you have to take 100 pages of Deathless Prose and just dump it and think about two or three scenes in 10 pages that will, you know, visually and for that medium in shorthand tell you what those 100 pages he threw out the window told you. And it's very tough to reinvent your own book when you've got it so deeply entrenched in you. I've never done this before. I feel like a cannibal eating his own foot.
This is the first novel of yours that doesn't come out of your life. All the others were in some way autobiographical.
Right.
Was it movies that got you out of yourself in terms of the subject of your writing?
Well, what happened is that, you know, like with The Breaks, I kind of felt bankrupt as an autobiographical writer. I started to feel like I went to the well too many times. And I decided that a solution out of that would be I had all these offers to do screenplays. And I decided, well, you tell me a story and I'll write it. I can't come up with any great epiphanic structures right now. I'm a pen for hire. Whose body do you want me to inhabit? You want me to be a pool hustler? Okay, no problem. You want to be a cop? Okay, I'll be an abstract artist. I'll be, you know, like the Headless Horseman. You just keep them checks coming. And, I'll just sort of refresh myself. I always knew it. I would be coming back to writing novels. I do believe that sometimes there are second acts in American lives. And I did. It took a lot longer than I thought it would take for me to get back to novels because, unlike cocaine, screenwriting is impossible to give up. And when you get good at it, the seduction is potent. It's, you know, constantly, well, you can work with this big star that you never worked with before and get this big check. You've never seen numbers like this before. And you're constantly, it's like they're throwing all this candy at you and you want to say, no, I'm going to go home and eat, you know, my whole wheat toast. You know, I'm going to do my novel because it's good for me and I've got to grow as a person. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that you do. And at some point, I just had enough.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
No, you're welcome.
Richard Price recorded in 1992 after the publication of his novel, Clockers. Price co-wrote the screenplay for the new film adaptation. He wrote the screenplay for Kiss of Death, which just came out on video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Randy Newman at the piano in the Fresh Air studio. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new solo album by the Icelandic singer-songwriter Björk, formerly of the band The Sugar Cubes. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Unstrung Heroes.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The singer and songwriter known as Björk was born in Reykjavik, Iceland in 1965. Until recently, she led the band The Sugar Cubes, but now she's out on her own. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of her new solo album, Post.
Rock and roll world is full of ditzy eccentrics who use the cover of pop music to indulge their self-conscious quirks. Björk is a little like that. She cultivates a winsome style, and the most characteristic noise she makes is a kind of muffled squeal. But in interviews, Björk has said, people, quote, look at me as being ethereal and mystical, but actually I'm quite organized, and I work hard. Indeed, at her best, Björk is much more than a ditzy eccentric. Or rather, she uses her ditziness to get at other emotions.
All the mutton sings like cars and such have always existed. They've just been waiting in a mountain.
As you can hear on that song, called The Modern Things, Björk sings English-language lyrics in an accent that combines with her phrasing to make the words elusive. You catch certain phrases and not others, and as a song proceeds, Björk builds a mood. When she was with the Sugar Cubes, the band often used her voice as just another instrument, and Björk let herself squawk and screech with an abandon that was sometimes thrilling, sometimes silly. On her new album, however, Björk is much more in control of her vocals, to such an extent that she can pull off this wonderful little trick, a parody of a schlock 50s saloon song that's better than lots of the songs it parodies.
So still, shh, shh, you're all alone, shh, shh, and so peaceful until you fall. Cry, you cross your heart and hope to die till it's over and then.
Björk now lives in London, where her boyfriend is Tricky, the so-called trip-hop artist whose album I reviewed here a few weeks ago. Like Tricky, Björk likes to play around with music's time and space, slowing down melodies until they stop, using silence for emotional punctuation, dropping the beat here and there. The results on Post may be eccentric, but they're also very shrewd.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Björk's new solo album, Post. Coming up, Randy Newman. This is Fresh Air. Randy Newman is one of the rock world's wittiest, most cynical, and most literate songwriters. He usually avoids confessional lyrics, preferring to speak ironically through the often unsavory characters he creates for his songs. His song Sail Away is a sales pitch to Africans to come to America to be slaves. Political science urges that we drop the atomic bomb. Later songs were written from the points of view of bigots, homophobes, murderers, and grotesques. Now Newman gets to sing in the persona of the devil. He's written a new music theater piece based on the Faust story. A theatrical production opens Sunday at the La Jolla Playhouse in California. The songs are featured on his new CD, Faust, with performances by Bonnie Raitt, Elton John, James Taylor, and Don Henley. Here's Randy Newman as the devil, singing Can't Keep a Good Man Down.
Listen to me. When you're on the bottom, like I am today, nose around, you're losing faith in what you're trying to do. There's only one thing a man can say. You can't keep a good man down. There've been mistakes, and I made a few. But oh, what a price I had to pay. Yet still they try to push me around. But they can't keep a good man down. There may be times when I feel low. I lose sight of the dream.
Don't lose sight of the dream.
But that's alright, soon I know I'll be back on top again. Running things, hey, hey. Treat a man like dirt. Give him no respect for who he is. Expect something dirty in return. Oh, they're flying high up there. They got a lot to learn. Because you can't keep a good man down.
In 1992, Randy Newman joined us in the Fresh Air studio and sat down at the piano for an interview and performance. He usually goes a few years between new CDs. He told me he hoped he was becoming more productive.
I used to, you know, lie out by the pool in the morning and send my kids off, you know, to school and say, you know, work hard, you know, come on, you know, do well in school. I was like sitting around, you know, talking to the pool man half the day. So, I mean, it was a bad example.
Well, you had.
They turned out all right.
You had Epstein-Barr for a while too.
Yeah, I did.
The disease where you have like no energy
where no one
at all
believes
for
you.
Months and years. You're right, yeah. And you can't get a diagnosis. But that's all behind you.
Yeah, good. So it went away like it came. Just it was gone. It was bad. Every once in a while, I have a day where I get up and, you know, my heart rate would like be 30-40 beats faster standing up than it was lying down. It was just hard to go from here to there. I feel very sorry for anyone who has it.
Let me ask you to do one of your older songs for us, a song that I think that most of our listeners will know. Would you do Political Science for
us?
We know it as Let's Drop the Big One.
And yeah, hopefully. It's never been out of date since I wrote it, but maybe it is now.
Yeah.
Nah, there's a trade war. No one likes us. I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize them. Asia's crowded, Europe's too old. Africa's far too hot and Canada's too cold. And South America stole our name. Let's drop the big one, there'll be no one left to blame us. We'll save Australia. Don't wanna hurt no kangaroo. We'll build down an all-American amusement park there. They got surfing too. Boom goes London and boom Paris. More room for you and more room for me. In every city, the whole world round, will just be another American town. Oh, how peaceful it will be. We'll set everybody free. You wear a Japanese kimono, babe. It'll be Italian shoes for me. They all hate us anyhow. So let's drop the big one now. Let's drop the big one now.
What a wonderful song.
Thank you.
How did you write that?
I don't know. I think it came fairly quickly. I don't remember the circumstances. Just, you know, there's always been that. This is that sort of xenophobia that's been in the country, that's always been here, always will be, you know, sort of cubed. I mean, almost no one is this nuts anymore, but few people are.
Have you developed a separate sound for accompanying yourself at the piano than you'd use if you were just sitting at the piano alone to play? I mean, do you think of yourself as having a sound that you use when you're singing?
A pianistic sound?
Yeah. I mean, I think of you as having one, but I couldn't explain it.
I don't think of it, but I probably just adjust to what I'm doing, yeah. I have a style of playing, I think, that I can tell it's me, if only because I can't keep time.
Is there a certain kind of left hand that you think of as you or something?
Oh, you know, my son does this imitation of me, you know, without him. He goes, you know, I'm very fond of shuffles. I have been all my life. It seems to be my natural mode of expression. My mother was from New Orleans. I don't know whether that has anything to do with it, but, you know, Blue Monday, I hate Blue Monday. Got to work like a slave all day. I mean, that's the stuff I love. And people don't tend to like shuffles that much, you know, and drummers hate them. But I've written more than I should have, you know. so maybe there's something to my left hand.
So when you first got access to a piano, when you were trying to do things that you heard?
As a kid?
Yeah, as a kid.
I never tried to do things I heard. I just played out of the little, you know, the Thompson from a wigwam book at the party. That was getting complicated there. But I never, there was music in my family. And I remember when I was about six, all of a sudden, there was like a piano in my room, you know, just in case I was Mozart, I think they wanted to have this thing looming, an upright, Hoffman upright, looming over me. My dad was a doctor, but he loved show business, you know. Before he went in the army, he went on that Hollywood Caravan tour. One of my uncles conducted that thing during the war, and he was a doctor on that. And I guess he never got over it. But, I mean, I think he wanted me to be a musician, though he never admitted it. I mean, what was the piano doing there, you know?
Right.
I didn't know what to do with it.
So did you impress them with your musical skill early on?
Yeah, I did with my ear. You know, they could play a record, and I would name them what it was when I was very young, apparently.
So if you started off playing all these, you know, piano for beginner type books, how did you start to learn rock and roll? Did you just pick it up from records? Could you?
I think I did when I was, started 15, 16. A friend of mine suggested, why don't you try and write some songs? His father was in the record business, so I did. And then a publisher signed me up. But it isn't like, you'll hear stories, I worked with Jeff Lynne on the last record, who was with ELO, and a lot of guys listened to a record, it did something to them, it clicked some kind of switch in them where they'd listen and copy the riffs on everything. I never did it. I was pushed kicking and screaming the whole way, it seems like, into music in some kind of ways. Even when I was in college and people would be all, they'd say, oh, did you hear Shostakovich's 11th Symphony? Or I don't know what it was then, about 11 maybe.
And I, you know, I hadn't heard, but I was better than everybody at composition classes and stuff like that. Worse at, you know, sight singing and things like that. But there, I was like, I was good at it. I had talent for it.
Were lessons forced on you?
No, but I never always felt I wasn't practicing enough, and I wasn't. I there's no doubt that I had some talent for it, and I probably have developed some of it too.
What
I know that sounds odd, but
what was the first kind of stuff you started writing at the piano for yourself?
The first thing I wrote was like a summer song. I was 16, 17. They tell me it's summer. It went. But I know it's a lie. Cause summer's for laughing. All I do is cry. Jeez, I don't know whose key this was. But anyway, it was recorded by the Fleetwoods. Man, they tell me it's summer. But I know it's a lie. Cause summer's for laughing. All I do is cry. Things like that, you know. Not really bad, but just vapid.
My guest is singer, songwriter, and pianist Randy Newman. Can I ask you to do a chorus of Lonely at the Top?
Sure.
I just think that's one of your really kind of fun songs.
I've been around the world. I've had my pick of any girl. You'd think I'd be happy, but I'm not. Everybody knows my name. But it's just a crazy game. Oh, it's lonely at the top. You know what I was noticing since you're sitting right here and I'm singing?
Yeah.
How hard it must have been, unless you're an actor in movies, you know, I was trying to look at you and sing. It's murder. It would be murder to listen, too, you know. I love you, I'll always love you. Jesus Christ.
It's really embarrassing to
I couldn't
to
do
be,
it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you don't know what to do. I don't know what to
exactly,
do.
Exactly, exactly. So are you averting your eyes?
Oh, very much so. I'm afraid. As a matter of fact, I'm glad I can't see audiences. You know, when you do TV, they're lit up. So, you know, you're playing along on Letterman or Saturday Night Live, and you can see the people, and, you know, you see talking to each other. I'm afraid to look.
Now, I remember from the last interview we did that you wrote that for Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, I did. And I thought it really would have been kind of hip if he did that.
Yeah.
And I played it for Streisand, but she said, well, people would believe it. You know, if she sung that, maybe she's right.
Do people believe it about you? Do they think that you're singing?
It depends. Some towns. You know, I used to play it in Philadelphia, strangely enough, where we are, and they wouldn't laugh. They'd think I was at the time, even if there were 12 people in the audience, you know, at a club.
You know, in talking about how you don't usually write the kind of like emotional, sincere song, like your song "Dixie Flyer" is, it's a very personal song. But by the end of it, you're talking about kind of anti-Semitism in a way.
Yeah, a lot of my songs I hope are moving. You know, it's just. I don't know. I had someone ask me, you know, are you going to start writing more personally like Dixie Flyer is now? And I said, no, I don't think so. I wanted to see if I could do something like that. But, I mean, I don't think my stuff is necessarily deficient in emotion because it's, I'm not the first person in the eye, you know. So I refute your argument. And shoot it down in flames and once again triumph to go on to further triumphs in cities around the country. Not a hard, mean man, but a gentle, understanding man who wishes his private life to remain. I mean, here's what I think. I think you could tell more about me, what I'd be like, just making a guess, coming in the studio and never seen me before. than you could about some of these people who are writing about, well, we made love in the meadow, and oh, I'm going there, over there, and I love you, I'll always love you. I mean, some of those guys are monsters, believe me.
I believe you.
I mean, but you could guess. You'd be pretty right about what I'd be like. I bet you could have guessed, maybe, that I wasn't the ogre that some have painted me. I rest my case. Innocent.
I really regret that we're out of time. I want to thank you so much, Randy Newman, for coming. It's just been wonderful to have you here. Thank you.
It's been good to be here.
Randy Newman recorded in 1992. His new musical, Faust, opens Sunday at the La Jolla Playhouse in California. The songs are featured on his new CD, Faust. Here's Newman singing the part of the devil.
Let me be your lover, boy. Just won't hold your hand. Something we might both enjoy. Can you understand? I've been waiting for a long time for you to tell me that you'll be mine. Honey, I'm doing the best I can, but I got to be your man. I got to be your man. I got to. That great big moon that shines down in the sky above, reminding me of love, baby. Gonna give it to you, and in our solitude, I'll hold you in my arm, captivated by your charm. Oh, oh, now you're gonna get it. When the morning sun comes up, I'll be there by your side.
This is Fresh Air. Screenwriter Richard LeGravenaise is on a roll. After being nominated for an Academy Award for The Fisher King in 1992, he got a lot of work, and this year, the fruit of his labors is suddenly everywhere. In his hit screenplay for The Bridges of Madison County, in his acclaimed screenplay for A Little Princess, and now in a new movie directed by the actress Diane Keaton. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Unstrung Heroes.
There are a lot of film genres that don't have a name yet. And Unstrung Heroes belongs to one of them. Call it the lovably eccentric family film. The genre goes back at least as far as 1938, when You Can't Take It With You was a big hit. But most of the lovably eccentric family movies since then have been pretty bad, mainly because if the eccentricities on display were truly lovable, they weren't very probable. And, on the other hand, if those eccentricities rang true, they were usually too grotesque and repugnant to fall in love with. In Unstrung Heroes, though, director Diane Keaton and screenwriter Richard LeGravenaise have found a lovely middle ground, and they've done it by employing a pretty neat trick. At first, we think the chief eccentric is the father of the family, Sid Litz, played by John Turturro. He's a mad inventor who won't give his son the birthday present he really wants because he'd rather invent for him a motor-driven remote control tent that creaks open over his bed every night. Still, his son, 12-year-old Stephen Litz, is happy. The time is the early 60s, the place is Los Angeles, and young Stephen is a nice Jewish boy growing up convinced that his father's a genius and his mother, played by Andie MacDowell, is a saint. Unfortunately, she's a saint who, it soon becomes clear, is dying of cancer. That's when the filmmakers launch what might be called the crazy uncle gambit. Stephen runs away to live with his two uncles, whose eccentricities make his father's look mild. Uncle Arthur and Uncle Danny are highly confrontational maniacs, and they confront their brother, Stephen's father, every chance they get. For one thing, they don't think Stephen should be named Stephen. With this kid's brains and his fantastic last name, he deserves better.
I've got it.
What?
Franz. Franz Liszt? It has a ring to it.
Franz. Yeah, Franz. Wow.
First of all, Franz Liszt is not an ancestor. Second of all, his name was spelled S-Z-T, not D-Z.
Well, those Ellis Island idiots got it wrong.
Yeah, they were bad spellers.
Franz Liszt. Oh, you're the one to look out for.
His name is Stephen.
Oh, Franz. Yes, you're the one to watch.
His name is Stephen.
What about a middle name?
I should just take a rocket to Venus. Maybe I can find some intelligent life there.
Well, you should pack a good lunch.
Yeah, he's right. It's a long trip.
Yeah, you might not like what they got to eat there.
Come on, Stephen. Come on.
You're Franz. Say it. Franz Liszt.
Maury Chaykin plays Uncle Arthur, the one who collects hallways full of old newspapers and closets full of rubber balls. Michael Richards, better known as Kramer from TV's Seinfeld, plays Uncle Danny, a paranoid leftist who teaches Stephen, or rather Franz, to sing the communist anthem while the rest of the kids at school are pledging allegiance. Too much of these abrasive uncles would have made the movie a tough slog. Too little would have left us to drown in the gooey sadness of a young boy slowly losing his radiant mother. But the filmmakers have mixed their elements carefully and have thrown in a few more. Diane Keaton's love of junk shop bric-a-brac turns the movie into a treasure trove of 60s memorabilia. Thomas Newman's score is wonderfully inventive, and the screenplay touches on a dozen sub-themes without hammering away at any of them. Unstrung Heroes is based on an actual memoir by a journalist who now calls himself Franz Liszt, and he's given some indications that the filmmakers have veered from the actual details of his life. It doesn't matter. What's on the screen may not always ring true, but it always resonates.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.